uniform force that's out, you know, contacting folks on the street. And we've had to get rid of our uniform gang enforcement presence just because of cuts. We have an investigative force. It's not the best way to do business. I understand how we got there. We're all short for people, and I appreciate our situation. But, you know, someday we'll probably have to start talking about that again.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Thanks
for your work.
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Camille Irwin. I'm supervisor of gang prevention services at Portland House of Emotion. Okay. Emotion's been working with McCoy Academy since November of 2006. We had a young man who attended Jefferson High School and was kicked out of there and transitioned into McCoy. Instead of the outreach worker just dropping him off at McCoy, he went in and established a relationship with McCoy and saw the need to provide life skills male responsibility group there. So he did that. He came back to Emoja and said, there's a lot of girls down there that fit the criteria that you guys might want to look at. So Jeff, one of the teachers at McCoy, offered the SEED program, a summer program, a credit retrieval program for young people. So through our main schools and PPS, we passed out the flyers. We had an amazing amount of young people who needed to recover credits. So what we did is we gave all the referrals back to McCoy, and they were accepted. 90% are on track for graduating because of McCoy to this day. And this is Fanny. She was one of the young people at Madison High School, and her grades were horrible. And we sent her over to McCoy for the summer, and she really did a great job. She went back to Madison at the beginning of the school year. I checked her grades 2 weeks into it, and she was failing all grades. So what I did is I called back to McCoy and said, can Fanny come back to McCoy? And they accepted her. So she's there now.
Yeah. I would also like to say that McCoy Academy has taught me to be a better person. And me coming to the SEED program during the 06 has taught me that I don't have to be in gangs, and I don't have to be doing what everybody else is doing. And I earned 1.5 credits during summer school, and I'm enrolled in House of Emoja. And LifeWorks taught me that I don't have to smoke and drink. And I also learned that to be myself, and I also want to graduate on time. And House of Emoja has taught me to be a better person, to get a job, and to stay away from gangs because there's no good, and I don't have to be around the people that hangs around my Northeast Portland neighborhood house. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Robert, Tom, is that all the folks to testify? Do we have a sign-up sheet?
We do. We have three people left. Okay. Teresa Teeter, Fannie Mae Dualt, and Jeff DeGrief.
Did we just hear from Fannie Mae? What was the last name?
Jeff. I believe it's Jeff DeGrief on Northeast 41st.
I'm going to come on up.
Teresa, Fannie Mae, and Jeff.
Fannie Mae just talked, so. Thanks for being here, folks. When you speak, state your name for the record, and you each have 3 minutes. Thank you.
Good morning. Good afternoon, whichever it is, Mayor Potter and council members. I'm a product of a state orphanage out of Nebraska, and I'm a downtown citizen advocate for the homeless and et cetera in Portland, Oregon. And I wanted to make comments regarding quite a bit of what I've heard. I highly agree that you need more funding for these programs. There's more youth hitting the streets than, you know, the age. They're all hitting of age faster and bigger groups. And I'm suggesting, as has been repeated, that business partnerships be created. And one of the things from, when I was living at the orphanage back in the 70s in Nebraska, I was paired up with Youth Employment System, a group called YES, and then Junior Achievement. and some other organizations. And as I became an adult, I was able to turn these things around. We had an organization we created out of a gentleman that won Powerball, and one of the first gang-related shootings in Omaha had him take his winnings and create Mad Dad's organization, of which I became, in the Lincoln, Nebraska area, one of the co-workers on that. And what we did was we took the at-risk youth and we took them on graffiti removal picnics. We did graffiti removal from all the businesses, bridges, and everything almost every weekend. Then we had a picnic afterwards if it was summertime. We did a one-time purchase of lawnmowers for certain kids to help them become entrepreneurs. And they took their lawnmower home in their gas can and they went out and made money. If they lost their lawnmower, they lost their lawnmower. And they didn't get another one unless they found a way to earn their own money. We had ethnic events for certain groups. I've discussed many times, I think, with the Lincoln Police Department paired up with our organization on Saturday nights at the YWCA. We had all four floors, and the youth did everything from swimming, basketball, etc. And condition of the youth gang members was I was the person that had to wrap up in toilet paper all the ninja blades, etc., for these youth to come participate. They weren't going to come if they were going to get their weapons taken away from them and not get them back because they needed them for their gang affiliations. Now, that worked back then. I don't think it would work now. But if it would get them off the street, we had to give them back their ninja blades and their knives and everything at the end of the evening, and they came every week and participated. Then they blended into softball programs, et cetera, and eventually these blades and knives and everything disappeared, and they became sustainable. And this has been about 15 years, and several of them I've run into are now community leaders in Lincoln, Nebraska. So I just wanted to bring some of these things forth. There were 35 gang-related shootings in North Omaha last year. I was there for the month of December, and a comment was made, I'm sorry, I need just one more minute, that there was more attention given to the mall shooting at the Von Maur Mall in Omaha, people coming forth with money to help pay for all these funerals and their medical care, and there was no money thrown to the gang-related shootings of the 35 people, innocent victims, et cetera, in North Omaha. And the chief of police resigned from his job quite suddenly in January this year. Quite a few police officers left, too, because they couldn't get a grip on the youth gang shootings. So also, one more quick thing. There's new legislation coming out in Nebraska that there has to be a gun safety lock in the trigger from any purchase of a gun, from anybody selling a gun. It's on the legislative record right now in Nebraska through the state. If you institute that through a city policy instead of waiting for it to go, that might help you get a grip on the gun control here. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Jeff DeGrief, and I'm a teacher at McCoy Academy. I helped organize what we did as far as the SEED program going on this summer. I'd like to just first of all say I'm very proud at this moment for my city for making a decision to invest in our youth. It was a very important decision for that to come down, and it was a critical time to bring these kids in. Secondly, I'm proud of this network of individuals that we have around us that are working together. There has been communication constantly taking place between the different services that are being provided. I don't think that that is always the case. And in this summer program, it congealed and things went very, very well. Lastly, and most importantly, though, I'm proud of the students that you see around you and the children. When we created this community and this network, what it did is it allowed them to make choices. And that's the key thing that we're charged with right here, is the ability for them to make a choice to do something other than get into trouble. And they did choose that. Of the 25 kids that we had come into our program, 26, we only had one leave for the summer, which is pretty miraculous. Over 90% attendance. Every kid earned from 1 to 3 credits for the school program. That's real change. That's something that's really taking place. Overall, we've talked about what difference everybody's making in this network, but I'd like to just bring out one specific situation. The recent shooting that did take place in North Portland was a student was involved that is in our program. Her boyfriend was the one that was shot. She came to our program over the summer and went back to school at a regular school. It did not work out for her. She dropped out and she came back to our program. She was on the street when it happened. She went to the hospital with him. The following day after this shooting, she came into our school. I don't know if you can understand the importance of that and what that means, but that means a kid who could have been out there doing other things at that point in time, who was gang affiliated and has been affiliated for many years, chose to come into school rather than get involved. And that's the difference that's being made on the ground, on the front lines that we're seeing right now. Those connections do make a difference. They are making a difference, and this money will make a difference.
Thank you.
We have one more person, Michael Johnson.
Good afternoon, members of the council. My name is Michael Johnson of Vancouver Avenue First Baptist Church. I'm a minister there. I'm also a reformed gang leader of North Portland. And I just want to, I heard a lot of good things spoken today. As far as the programs and services that are working. But I want to speak towards the forces of unseen forces, and I want to speak towards the foreseen forces that are going against the programs that are established, that are thrive making and continue to keep thriving of the gang members that are out there and bringing forth new gang members. The unseen forces is that a lot of gang members are coming about, a new generation is coming about. It's considered the third and fourth generations. And that's the generations from children of my of my seeds. I have children, I have seven actually, in the midst of my my gang life. And so now those seven are being brought up. Well, there's a lot of other reformed gang members who have children too. And they have knowledge of knowledge of how gangs act. They have knowledge of how to run a gang. They have knowledge of how to go under the radar. And so in that perspective, there's gang members and there's new gang members out there that are not program-oriented. And so I heard it mentioned that it was brought up that it's not enough workers out there, not enough outreach workers, not enough preventive workers out there. And there is not enough preventive workers out there. Not only did the Portland Police state that, but I'm a community member who can also state that. And being in the community and working with the second generation gang members who are either on parole or probation, who are looking for an avenue to give back to their community. One of the things is there's a stigmatization on them that they cannot have that opportunity to give back because there's not enough programs for them to be part of. Or the programs that they're a part of, they don't meet the qualifications because they don't have the training or they don't have a high school degree. But they do have the experience because they were part of the gang. They were part of that era that came to Portland in 1984, all the way through the 80s and 90s. But they do have the experience. I'm a living witness to that. I was part of the gang program that John Canada had overseen. Due to lack of fundings, I was no longer part of that program, such as a lot of the other workers. But by God's grace, I was able to continue the direction that I wanted to go and become part of a church. Not only become part of a church, but have the determination to grow within the church, and not only that, to give back and reach others that are still out there. And there's a lot of still out there. You have, I think I saw maybe 157 different gangs now in Oregon. You have, from the 90 generation, the 90 era, maybe six that are very established, which are the Columbia Villa Crips, the Kirby Crips, the 60s, the 20s. You have the Blood Gangs that are the Rolling 20s, the Pyrus, the Denver Pyrus. There's so many that are still out there, but under the radar, because now laws have changed to react to the behavior that is out there. And gang members react to the laws, and so they change their behaviors. And so they're still out there. You spoke of the incidents on the light rail. Well, of course, if you put more police out there, they're not going to do the crime. But soon as the police leave, they're going to do the crime. And it's cheaper to hire outreach workers than the police. It's cheaper to have volunteers who are willing to go out there and show example to give back to their community, which I'm speaking of gang members who are trying to tie into the community, whether they tie into their church.
Your time is up.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you.
And I think it was a good way to close this session, because you're absolutely right, is that there aren't enough resources. When I met with these providers a few months ago, that was the final message that they gave me, is that they could do so much more. And so resources, I think, are really critical to the final solutions, and not just resources for enforcement, but resources for prevention and intervention. So thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Is that it?
Unless Fannie Mae DeWalt, did she return?
Okay. I want to thank Rob Ingram, Tom Peavy, and Harry Jackson, all of the providers, the young people, particularly those that came up and testified, and our police for coming in to talk about how they interface with prevention. It's an important issue for our community, and it's one that needs close watch, not just because of the gang shootings increase, but because it's a continuing problem in our community, and it's robbing our young people of their future. So this was a briefing to the council, and there's no council action required. If you folks want to make any statements, you're more than welcome to.
I actually had a question for staff.
Okay. Rob, could you come forward? Tom?
So on that last point of, you know, not having enough resources, and sort of paging through the write-ups in the back, which I really appreciate. I counted, and they didn't all mention them, but I counted about 100, 150 slots for youth available, although some, we just, the money went to hire a worker, and I assume does a lot of outreach, so it's a little bit of apples and oranges. But how do you make sure that the people that are going into these very limited slots because of lack of resources are the youth that are most at risk of engaging in some sort of gang violence?
All right. Well, it's a little bit of a science to it. One of the most tested methods is that a lot of the outreach workers work directly with the schools. Carl Rucker and Timo Bautista specifically from ECS and El Programa Español. And so the schools give them a call whenever they it doesn't necessarily have to be an incident, whether they think there's an incident, whether they see any type of behavior or clothing or graffiti or signage in the bathrooms, or whether they hear from a teacher that this particular kid is lacking in attendance or is acting out or having any type of issues in that order. And also the police provide information in that capacity at the gang violence task force meetings. So often the police will bring up a name that wasn't necessarily a person that got shot, but was involved in any type of gang activity. And that's the forum where those names are then discussed, and we find out who else knows that child, who might be working with them, and who can therefore partner up and try to create some positive outcomes. So does that answer your question?
Yes.
So, yeah.
I just wanted to say this is a very impressive report and good work, and appreciate the providers and the youth who are here today. But and our work is still ahead of us in this area for a long time, it seems. And, you know, I hope the mayor will be proposing in his budget a package similar to what we did this year, if not even greater, to continue to support some of these organizations and to continue to support your office and the good work that's going on, and maybe even to get more outreach workers on board. So good job.
Thank you. Thank you. A side note also, commissioners, that we are working with the outreach. We will begin to work with the outreach workers through the Parks and Rec program just to create a continuum there.
Park's been really good.
Well, I'm deeply troubled by what I've heard here today, particularly given the and certainly nothing that you guys are doing, quite the contrary. I'm heartened that we have outstanding people that are assigned to this task. I just had the opportunity to meet with Rob for the first time yesterday. I'm very impressed with his background. Not the least of which is he went to Grand High School, which is always a plus. But I really appreciate your focus and kind of your whole approach. But I'm troubled because of the, obviously here in the stats that we're now seeing gang-related incidents at summer levels. And what strikes me in thinking about that is, in contrast, when we, the mayor and I and the council, have worked in the last 4 years to try to come up with a, what now appears to be a pretty simple formula of identifying people who are committing crimes in the community, put them in jail, get them to sober up, get them in treatment, they drop out of the system. Seems pretty simple now here after hearing this, because that formula doesn't appear to apply to gang violence. I mean, it appears there are other factors besides drugs and alcohol motivating the behavior. And so I'm troubled because I just can't get my arms around a simple approach, probably because there's not an approach such as we are using with people who are committing crimes and we get them in jail and then get them into treatment. Doesn't sound like it fits into that paradigm quite so simply. So I guess the one hope I see is, you know, I think Tom with your background and Harry Jackson with his background and now Rob, you on board, I see some opportunity for you guys to try to dissect that a little bit and try to figure out how best we can attack this problem. Because, I mean, hearing what I did today, we're just lucky that people just even yesterday weren't killed in gang violence. So I'm troubled, and I know that you are as well, and I'm looking for solutions. So whatever I can do to help you guys achieve your mission, I would be more than happy to do, including, you know, other programs, resources. Because the one thing I have learned is if we prevent people from doing crimes, it is much cheaper than hiring the police or having the jail beds. And so it all makes a lot of sense to me. But thanks for taking this on. This is a big challenge.
Thank you for your support, Commissioner.
I'd like to follow up with you, Commissioner, regarding those five beds out at JDH.
Yes.
Juveniles are handled differently than adults. Right. So I don't know that the same rules apply across the board, but I would be willing to work with you to see what we could do.
Okay.
And perhaps use also some of the community treatment resources that were here today to begin to leverage them, not to keep them there, but to use that as the means by which to get them involved in some of the prevention programs.
I'll do a little looking into that and then check with you on what's available. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Commissioner, to add on, the stats lately are disheartening for us. It's not discouraging, but it's disheartening. It's unfortunate to hear. One of the things I've learned from my experience is that we're dealing with forces that typically are generational. Mm-hmm. So one of the issues is we're dealing with the whole family. So you saw parents here today. Right. You know, we're dealing with issues where the behavior that we view is the product of something deeper than that.
Right. So. Exactly. But not necessarily drugs or alcohol motivated. Correct.
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
And the nice part about it is we have the platform established through the office and its connection with the Gang Violence Task Force and the Police Bureau and other service providers that aren't part of the grantee program to be able to sit at the same table and discuss exactly what you're talking about is trying to define the target in which service dollars are applied to at-risk populations.
Yeah.
So that's an ongoing process that's been provided through the opportunity or through the creation of this office and the guidance that the Gang Violence Task Force has provided.
To not recreate any programs.
Right.
Also, we're working with literally the country. So we're working with Los Angeles, we're working with Washington State, we're working with Boston, and we're looking at what other models have fared well and what have not done well.
It sounds like you're doing the right thing.
Well, there's one area I'd like to revisit. First off, thank you for your work. I really appreciate it, and thanks to all the community providers for your good work. The recreation, I think, though, we need to revisit the notion of recreating the gang enforcement unit that would include uniformed officers. And I realize that it's a question of resources and allocation of resources and availability of bodies. But if we're seeing an increase, if we continue to experience this increase, I think having, as we heard from the commanders today, looking at recreating that, if they're asking for it, which they did, or came close to it today, I think we should seriously consider reestablishing that gang response unit.
You know, the problem is that the police bureau can't hire enough people to replace the ones that are retiring. and that this is a national thing. It's not just with Portland. It's not with Oregon. It's across the country. People, fewer people are going into policing. And so it's a real issue. I've been meeting with the chief and talking about using, for instance, our reserves to recruit from, because we've got a very low number in the reserve unit right now. We want to increase that significantly. There's a huge backlog of doing the backgrounds, and that's always a sticking point for hiring people because the background takes so long. We're trying to figure out how to reduce that time. Often when people, we have a four-year requirement. That interferes. I don't know if you read the story.
Yeah.
That in Hillsborough, the guy went to Hillsborough, and now he's an outstanding officer there. We could have hired him, but he didn't have the 4 years. The chief is looking at using substitutes like 4 years of experience in a law enforcement agency somewhere else, 4 years as a reserve officer, so we can use that as a substitute for a college degree. We got to look at different ways to try to get more people in. We've got to get people in from communities of color. And so the Police Bureau has been working with PCC to try to get a program to start talking to high school schoolers about going into policing, so we can start at an earlier age.
Like,
they're doing a lot of different things, but it's a really difficult issue.
And it is national.
And it is national. And whenever we put officers into specialty assignments, mm-hmm. it takes them away from the street. And the street is sort of where the basic sure. police work gets done.
And I appreciate the challenge of that. My concern is, though, that if we don't try to nip this in the bud now, it's just a lot harder to deal with that later. So I absolutely understand these are difficult trade-off decisions. I would just like to revisit, in this case, making some trade-offs, as difficult as they are, to try to nip this in the bud before it gets out of control.
I'd like to give you some reaction, Mayor Potter, to that comment about the educational levels. I remember here a while back, Chief Sizer recommended that we drop those educational levels, and she got some pushback. And I wrote her an email and personally met with her and told her I couldn't agree with her more, that I think that it has been a huge mistake over the last few decades to transition from when you and I were hired in the Fire and Police Bureaus to hiring solid people with good common sense and who had demonstrated life skills that didn't have college degrees or any college at all, but a high school diploma. And I think that we have unwittingly created problems for ourselves by just, and it kind of feeds off the last person that testified to, who was talking about people that are excluded, that don't have good skills, that have good skills that don't have the educational requirements. And I think the same is true with police officers. I would be wholeheartedly supportive of changing the requirement so that, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if they have a high school diploma and they've demonstrated a good, upstanding kind of approach to life in their background and whatever job they had, I think people like that make excellent police officers. They know what it's like to struggle. It's, you know, I used to say this to incoming firefighters that didn't like hearing this, that I think in some ways we've lost a sense of community by hiring people who only have degrees, because not everybody in our community obviously has degrees. And I think it's a working, I think police and fire work are blue-collar jobs, and we've tried to make them something other than that, but that's what they are, and we should be proud of that and hire the best people. And I know many people that don't have a college degree or any college at all that are very, I mean, absolutely stellar people who by definition can't be police officers. It doesn't make sense to me. I think we could open up our pool quite a bit by being, I think, a little more thoughtful about the group that we allow to apply. And I think we would see outstanding police officers come from the blue-collar working-class jobs. I mean, it used to be when the mayor and I were hired, people would apply because they were tired of riding on the back of a garbage truck or laying in a ditch doing construction work. And I have to tell you, we have great firefighters, but I've never worked with people better in fire or police than those folks who came in after working blue-collar jobs out in the community for a while, and they loved the fact that they had a great, you know, a job that people respected, and they made good money and had a pension. And I think we've lost that pool of people unwittingly by increasing the standards in both bureaus, educational standards.
Two things to that. I was alarmed, Commissioner Adams, when I found out that the gang enforcement team has moved to full investigative and no officers on the beat. That's scary for us, because what's happened now is they rely more on the outreach workers that you heard from today for that investigative information, and obviously it's not what it could have been. So and I'll leave the rest of it up to you. And for Commissioner Leonard, if that diploma can be from Grant, and I think it
right there. Yeah, exactly.
I just like to add an addition.
Now you're just pandering.
Yeah, that's pandering.
No, he's not. Rob. He's just proven what a great
you're
guy
a good
is.
Politician. You're a good politician.
Commissioner Adams' statement regarding the need to have officers on the street to do outreach prevention that they used to be able to do in the 90s when they had a gang unit that did basically that. In the 90s, they also had outreach workers at a level that has never been seen since. And in 2006, we lost a lot of the programs. We got down to minimum on some. It really takes a combination of both. And so, you know, because the lives of the kids that really aren't involved in gang activity hang in the balance, as you saw in the initial slide of our presentation, that through our survey of 675 kids that are at-risk youth that we've touched with those seven organizations, 286 of them, or 42%, said they'd been recruited for gang activity, most of those in their own neighborhoods. Now, those kids are not gang entrenched at this point. It's the entry door. Is a police officer on the street going to address all the needs of that child? And we have to look at the full holistic treatment of youth that are at risk in these communities. And outreach workers definitely serve a purpose. And I know we're dealing with limited funds, but at the same time, there's a desperate need for outreach workers in the field.
Yeah, I'd echo that remark. I mean, I think Pastor Michael Johnson just said it in his closing remarks. You know, outreach workers are less expensive, and they're more on the preventative end of things. And they're not city employees, but they work in nonprofits that typically are struggling. And to the extent we can, through this, our office, your office, you know, provide some secure funding and hopefully increase the pool of outreach workers, I think we're all going to be better off for that.
Thank you.
I totally agree that it's not one or the other, it's both. And what I see right now is we have maybe not enough. I'm willing to invest more in the outreach, but I'm also willing to consider, you know, the trade-off within the Bureau in terms of assignment of personnel, since we are seeing this uptick right now, some uniformed officers assigned to a gang response team. Mm-hmm. And if it dies back down, you know, but right now I just, you know, having been through the mid-90s on this, you know, once it starts rolling, it can exponentially get out of control, and you needed to hit it on a number of different levels. But not having some assigned uniformed officers to get out there, I think is a real problem. Thank you
for the presentation. It was really good.
Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
We are recessed until 6 p.m. tonight.
Is that gonna be a long one?
Well, you're not running it, so no.
I
apologize. It does have an Adams like.
Oh no.
We have five invited panels, but.
Oh, that's not bad.
Panels.
Five. Oh, that's easy. What are you complaining about?
I hope to get it all done by 8. Mayor, if you want to limit testimony to 2 minutes, if that's a lot of people here at once, that's why I'm fine with that too.
So, Tom, when I was at the Fire Bureau, that's when they changed the educational requirements. And so when they hired people, then they said, well, we're going to give you preference if you have a 2-year degree, to get more preference if you have a 4-year degree. Before that, it had been pretty much the interview panels were firefighters and fire people from the construction trade and all that, and they made great fire. So they found that when they changed the educational requirement, I didn't say this on purpose, but I don't want to offend anybody. They found that once they... when they changed the educational requirements, get these kids, and then they didn't know how to really take pictures.
You start as